Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the Ocean Protect Podcast, talking about the issues that face our oceans and what we can do about it. Presented by Ocean Protect, committed to change.
Dr. Matt Landos, welcome to the Ocean Protect Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Brad.
I'm a bit of a social media creeper. I've been following you for quite some time, Matt, and you've been very active and outspoken on social media. And it's not about Kim Kardashian's and what's happening on Married at First Sight. It's actually some really important issues. So I am definitely keen to just dive straight into them. Big thanks to Ken Rogers from the University of Technology Sydney for linking us up as well. Before we go into your area of expertise, what do you actually do for a job?
My professional job is working as a veterinarian, but it's a little bit an unusual sector of the veterinary world in that I work dominantly on things with gills.
Yeah.
So these are all the aquatic species from oysters and mussels right through to abalone, fish, prawns. These are all my clients, if you like. And I work all around Australia with both wild capture fisheries and aquaculture.
You're a qualified veterinarian. Your background is in cows and probably all creatures, great and small, but now fish and other aquatic species.
I've always had quite an interest in aquatic animals, even coming through as an early teenager, had quite some interest in the aquatic environment. And had taken a look at whether the marine biology road was the one to go down, but I took on some advice from people around me that suggested that perhaps rather than ending up as a guide on a tourist boat talking about potato cod, I should consider a veterinary degree because it opens up a wider range of options. It led me back into fish, although I did run for 5 years via all of the other, I guess, more traditional species that vets deal with in terms of working as a dairy cattle veterinarian, in production medicine and cats and dogs and chickens and ostriches and everything else. These days, it's all aquatic species I work with. Whilst it seems miles apart from the small furries, it's a lot closer than you think. The conserved evolutionary biology is remarkable. When you start getting into how close things are, you begin to realise we're not so far or so long ago, really, that we stepped out of the water as the first vertebrates started moving on land as amphibians. Most of the biology was conserved. So the hormone systems of animals, for example, are extraordinarily similar in fish all the way through to humans. So fish have the basic running gear, if you like, that we do. They have testosterone, they have estrogen. It's very similar to the exact same molecules in humans. They have testicles, they have gonads, they have livers, spleens. Their intestine is extraordinarily similar to our own as a monogastric animal. Veterinary science is taught as a comparative study in medicine. So you're able to take knowledge from one species and apply much of it across to the next one. Not all of it, but much of it certainly applies. And so much so, today we see fish being the dominant animal used in research for all of the human diseases. So rats and mice are being used less and fish are being used more to inform us about risks in relation to perhaps a new pharmaceutical or a combination of toxicants that we want to understand how they impact potentially on humans. So we use fish as a model.
That is absolutely fascinating. I remember talking to Peter Hammerstedt on a recent podcast episode, and he was saying, yeah, the reason that we don't really relate very well to fish in terms of recognizing them as a sentient being is they don't have eyelids, which I never even thought about. But so debunking myths quickly. So I guess fish feel pain. They don't have short-term memories. Like I think the term is like a memory like a goldfish. So those things aren't true. Is that what I'm hearing?
Fish certainly have some remarkable capacities that probably put some of our capacities into the shade. These days, most of us can't find our way around without our phones and the inbuilt GPS. But some of our fish species we know can go from a river where they're born, way up in the top of British Columbia. They can swim out of that stream, out into the Pacific Ocean, swim a few thousand kilometres in a gigantic migratory loop, feeding and growing as they go. And without a single signpost, no directions, no advice from a backseat driver, they arrive back in the very same stream that they were born in. And they do this, we believe, through very small chemical signals from that river, imprinting them with a sense, this incredible sense of smell that they have to track and find their way back. So these sort of features of these animals are remarkable. And I think if we put ourselves in this situation and said, okay, I'm just going to swim out to sea for 3,000 kilometres and then paddle my way back in and land in the same stream with all the oceanic currents and variables, I don't think we'd make it.
And obviously, I guess your passion for all things aquatic has sort of led you down this path, and also being quite vocal around key issues affecting the health of our aquatic friends. I see you quoted in a Garden article today, and I'll include a link in the show notes. The article is called "The River Has Been Destroyed. Expert Says Agriculture Has Overshadowed Science in the Murray-Darling Basin." And lo and behold, you're there getting quoted. And I found it particularly interesting what you were saying. You've obviously done a lot of work around the Richmond River estuary. You're obviously living in Ballina, and that's where you're dialing from today. But for people who haven't read that article, could you give some, I guess, overview of what they're talking about in terms of the river has been destroyed?
Yeah, so they're talking about the Darling in particular in the article, so the upper part of our Murray-Darling system. There have been now quite a lot of investment in studying which fish are present and how many of them are present. So biologists going out and using various forms of both trapping and capture with electrofishing to understand numbers of fish and how these relate to conditions in terms of rainfall or floods and through time. Now, what they're finding is really quite alarming. There are now a complete loss of one of our very significant native species, the silver perch. It was formerly present in very large numbers. In fact, some of our first explorers in their diary reports talked about these massive schools of fish that they saw in waters so easy that the local people, our First Nations people, were able to spear them readily for food. So these were abundant. Now, they described them as extirped, which is a funny word, but it means they're no longer there. So we have what's called a functional extinction of the species. From an entire, we're talking hundreds of kilometres of river, and one of our formative common native species is now gone. We're also seeing the Murray cod, really an icon of our inland fisheries, also dramatically declining. And in some areas, again, in hundreds of kilometres of river, the scientists haven't trapped one since about 2019. So we're talking long periods of time, annual surveys, and species that were formerly common are not there. Now, on top of that, we've been seeing recurrent fish kills in the river. So these have been events that have attracted some media attention. Most of that attention has focused around the kills at a particular spot called Menindee or Menindee Lakes in far western New South Wales. Now, that's really the site at which the cameras met with the floating dead fish. Part of it was brought on by some of the local people, really alarmed about the state of their local river, who sought to publicise it through their own efforts on Facebook. So they were publishing videos of themselves highlighting the carcasses of these floating old animals in their local river and saying, you know, it really wasn't good enough. And I agree with them. It certainly isn't. There was a massive kill there in 2018. And then we've now had a further kill in 2023. Again, very, very significant event. In fact, so significant. When we go back to the First Nations people throughout the area of the Murray-Darling Basin and question them about, is there any history of kills like this pre-European settlement of Australia? They say no.
Wow.
Now, that's interesting elsewhere around the world, that's not the case. So our Australian native fish are a bit different to the Northern Hemisphere fish like salmon. So when a salmon swims up the river, the Pacific salmon, they swim up and after they spawn, they die. So there is a mass mortality that takes place naturally in salmon. And in those systems, that death is actually part of the natural cycle to create nutrients in the water that feed the bottom of the food web that help their larvae, their progeny, survive. Now, that's a very particular life cycle that's established over millennia in that environment of the western part of North America. Now, in Australia, that's not what our native fish do. They don't perish after they spawn. In fact, they live very long lives, many of them. So our Murray cod can live out to over 50 years of age should conditions be suitable for them. Now, but what we've been seeing is these massive kills. This is not normal. When we go to the British Columbia Indian culture, those First Nations people in Canada, they do have ceremonies and cultures and memory about the annual mortality. So these events are of such a scale and size that their civilization sought to remember them through having them embedded in culture. Yet our First Nations people have no recollection at all of these types of kills. And so whilst they haven't necessarily written things down in a documented form, I think we can take some confidence from their memory that what we're seeing now never happened. It's not normal. It's not something that should be happening regularly. It is a function of what we've done to the catchments. And this is, I guess, where my interests have really collided in recent years, because I've been interested in what's happening to the fish. I've sort of been crawling back up the bank to look over the bank and say, what's up here? And could that be affecting what's down here? And beginning to recognise that there's strong connections between our landscapes, how we use them, and what ends up in the water in terms of what we might broadly call water quality that the fish are most interested in.
That's fascinating, because that is basically inconsistent with, I guess, what you often see reported, I'll say often in the media, but often by our government agencies. And, you know, fish kills do happen quite commonly, I guess, nowadays in Australia. And I think, I'm not sure if they still do, but I remember the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries used to keep a record of fish kills, and they used to try and explain them. And there's lots of them. And I remember one happening recently in Western Sydney in, I think, the Parramatta River, I think it might have been. And they dismissed it as a natural event. And that really doesn't sit well with me. And I saw you've had similar experiences. So fundamentally, these fish kills that we're seeing in the Murray-Darling Basin, from your perspective, they are not natural. Is that correct?
No, they're not natural. Correct. Not natural. And they are induced by how we've managed the landscape, which effectively creates the water, if you like, that's in the river.
So just to clarify, what have we changed then? So what are the key pressures that are impacting on the water quality within these river systems that are causing these fish kills?
Well, we do need to go quite a ways back to begin understanding what we've done. Now, there's some really interesting, I think, linkages, how this fits together. So one of the things that we've done is expand farming. And in Australia, from the earliest times, we took on the British model of farming, which was that you must clear the land to make it arable, and that this was part, in fact, we even use terms like this was part of developing a civilized agrarian society. This was the aim back in 1860 when Governor Robertson started offering free settler land title in New South Wales, was that you in fact had to clear the land of native vegetation. Now, at the time, I don't think there was much appreciation for what that native vegetation did. We know now that native vegetation literally made rain. So we know that forests make rain. So we have decreased our rainfall. That's the first thing we did, by deforesting vast landscapes across New South Wales, indeed across the nation, for agriculture. That dramatically changed the water cycle. It changed the evaporation rates off the land. It changed the temperatures of the land. It changed the temperatures of the water. So just the removal of snags and trees from the riverbanks to allow access for cattle for drinking, and in some areas to allow, like the Richmond River, where forestry for cedar logs was a big thing, we ripped all the snags out of the river so it could float the logs down to the sawmill and to the boats to take them off and generate an economy off the early timber industry. So literally every single snag, so old timber that was stuck in the river, that was part of the ecology and the habitat of the species living there, was pulled out and burnt on the bank. So we radically changed the stability of riverbanks. We introduced cattle as part of our agricultural economy. Again, a British step in that direction. A cloven-footed beast with hard hooves. Cattle have a significant impact on what we call the riparian or the streamside vegetation on our rivers. They eat it, they trample it, they defecate and urinate in those areas. They destabilize the banks of the rivers, which then, because of the loss of vegetation cover and loss of trees, we see these banks being undercut and collapsing, and a massive change in sediment movement into our rivers. So we now see massive fluxes of sediment from our landscape. So our quite ancient soils in Australia, we're literally washing them away down our rivers at a rate that is well and truly unprecedented pre-European settlement in Australia. We see massive changes all the way out into our marine landscape. In the recent rainfall of the last few years, just in places like Moreton Bay in Queensland, we see the bottom of Moreton Bay changing, going from areas of seagrass to areas of mud. And we're not talking meters squared, we're talking hundreds of hectares of change over less than a decade. These are profound changes to the aquatic ecosystem that have profound effects.
Yeah, and speaking as a local, like that means dugongs in Moreton Bay feed on that seagrass, and it's an iconic species, incredibly amazing, and they just got no food. So they fundamentally will die off in time if that doesn't change.
That's right. So we have the sediments. So this is sort of some of our earliest impacts. Then we move to what was it's become known as the Green Revolution, which seems like a great irony of a title to me, which was when pesticides and synthetic fertilizers became the basis for food production. This happened after the Second World War, when products which were developed in Germany as products of warfare, chemical warfare, were then repurposed after the war to create the war on bugs. This was the war on insects. And we then rebranded them into crop protection products, which sounds an awful lot safer, unless you're a bug, in which case we have rained terror down on the bugs at a rate that is still increasing, both here in Australia and globally. We are increasing the amount of pesticides annually. In Australia, we've doubled the amount of pesticides in the last decade that we're applying to our landscapes.
Wow.
These are big volumes. We're talking, it's a multi-billion dollar industry in Australia, and it forms a huge cost on agriculture as an input cost. So our growers who are making only marginal amounts of profit, sending much of their profit to the chemical companies who are the primary beneficiary of this model of farming. But all the benefits that are described within the paddock of using a chemical that you might increase yield of the crop, there are downsides. But the downsides are not discussed in the same dialogue with the farmer, and they're not certainly not discussed with the public, and they're not considered within the Department of Agriculture or, interestingly, the Department of Health in Australia. Now, these costs are things that are bearing down on the aquatic environment. So our water around Australia is contaminated with pesticide runoff from application that occurs both in agriculture, but not only there. Our councils use ample amounts of herbicide in roadside spraying. Our home use is also quite extraordinary in urban areas for products that might control termites or ants or spiders or fly spray or products on dogs to control fleas and ticks. We use a lot of chemical. Now, it doesn't stay where it's put. It runs off and it ends up in our waterways, ends up in our water. Now, this creates costs. If a municipal water authority wants to supply a town with clean drinking water that we describe as potable to meet a national standard, we can't be giving people lots of chemicals in their water. That's not okay. We know that's harmful. So we treat it. And it costs a lot of money to get chemicals out of water. Hence, our potable water costs are significant, and they're a significant public cost. Not all communities get the same quality water because not all communities have the same treatment plant. Some communities are likely being exposed to unsafe levels of chemicals, creating chronic disease issues in those communities. And we see these problems creating public health costs in Australia. We have one of the highest rates of cancer in the world in Australia. This is not just bad luck. It's not just because the sun comes out. We know that pesticides, as one significant toxicant exposure, are a significant contributor to the rates of cancer development in humans and animals. So it's not perhaps obvious to people who might support the McGrath Foundation on their breast cancer support programs that dogs have elevated rates of breast cancer. And each year the rates are going up.
There's a lot to take in here, Matt. Wow, I shouldn't laugh, but yeah.
Yeah, so this is where water is a very integrative thing in that we all need it. Our bodies are made up of quite a large percentage of our bodies are made of water. We have to drink it daily. We need it to produce our food. But increasingly, it's contaminated. And that is a problem for the quality of the food that we're able to produce, the safety of the food, and the impacts on health and on fish, for example. One of the other papers highlighted some of the long-term risks that can come from a tiny exposure.
This article you're referring to, yeah, and I'll include a link in the show notes. It's from fhys.org, and it's titled, "Even Very Low Levels of Pesticide Exposure Can Affect Fish for Generations, Studies Find." And it is unbelievable. Like, we're talking nano concentrations, like a teaspoon in an Olympic swimming pool, causing impacts that will extend over generations of fish species. It's staggering.
So some of these chemicals, this particular paper looked at an insecticide, a few different pyrethroid chemicals. Now, pyrethrum is a natural insecticide made by one of our flowering plants. However, the natural form is quite short-acting. What the chemical industry has done is create a product that, in their view, has more utility for crop producers by making it long-acting. They've changed the chemistry of the pyrethrum. They've often added fluorine into that chemistry, which tends to make it much longer acting and very persistent in our environment. So people are familiar with, or slowly becoming familiar with, the term PFAS, which they might have heard in relation to firefighting foams and other uses like non-stick fry pans. In fact, there's many uses of that class of chemical Well, some of our pesticides are now classified by OECD as PFAS pesticides. So this addition of fluorine is a key component of how things are classified. This paper looked at an exposure of 1 nanogram a litre of some of these pyrethroid chemicals. What was critical was the timing of the exposure. Getting a little bit into the biology of development, essentially, you and I, we both started as a combination of one sperm and one egg. And when we got going and we became a couple of cells fairly quickly, and then we started dividing. We were 4 cells and we were 8 cells, and we kept going. During that process of cell division, very early embryonic development, the cells are talking to each other. The language they use is they use tiny signaling chemicals to tell each other where to go and what to become. So cells are saying, okay, you go up here and become an eye, and you're going to go down there and you're going to become a finger, and you need to become a liver. So you best develop a little differently. Now, that cell process, the concentrations of chemicals that are controlling cell division and controlling the development are in nanograms a litre. They're tiny, tiny amounts of natural chemicals controlling natural development. The problem that we've discovered, and the discovery was back in the late 90s, is that a whole range of chemicals can interfere with those messages. They might act like one of the messengers. So some chemicals we know can act a bit like estrogen. So they can have a feminizing effect. Some chemicals can act like an anti-androgen or anti-testosterone. So they have a demasculinizing effect. So these interactions can lead to a very different animal that develops. So it may not stop the development, but it can change it, and change it in ways that can not only affect the development of that embryo, but what we see is what's called transgenerational impacts. That is that the embryo's progeny, so when that embryo grows up to become an adult and has children, even if that adult is never exposed to the chemical again, the child can have legacy impacts that relate to the exposure that the parent had previously, the grandparent.
At very low concentrations, yeah.
Yeah, from an exposure that might have only been a few days during pregnancy. This is the power that chemicals can exert on our biology and in essence, how fragile our tremendously complicated biology is. It can be disturbed by what is now quite a cocktail of chemicals, which we kind of live in. It's probably the easiest way to understand what we do with chemicals now, because we're getting them from many different sources. We have them via food. So we have our pesticide residues, which are permitted in food. We have plastics, which have a huge industry of chemicals embedded in the plastic. It's not just a polymer. It has anywhere up to about 12,000 chemicals are used by the plastics industry to make it a different color, to make it UV stable, to make it flexible, to make it rigid. These additive chemicals go into the mix to make a plastic. But the problem with them is, one, they can go in, they can come out. We see that foods that are packaged in plastic contain the plasticizers in the food. They move from the plastic into the food and then from the food into us. We, of course, have many different contacts to plastic. Our clothing can be plastic. So we have polyester clothing. This can touch our skin. Our skin is porous. Now, we will take a very small, but we'll take on a small exposure. We're inhaling plastic. So in the air, we now have micro and nanoplastics in the air. There's so much around, we're breathing it in. We are breathing many other things in too. Australia's terrible vehicle emission standards, which are on the cusp of being improved, if they're not rolled back by lobby groups, we're already breathing in poor quality air that contains excessive amounts of very fine particles and toxicants like PFAS, like hydrocarbons. These things combine build onto this cocktail of exposure that we now have, and that in my day job at my fish hat. These are now things that are really contributors to the health and the productivity of our fisheries and aquaculture.
I think a few people have just started coughing a little bit more than they did before, Matt. And I must admit, when I've seen your post for a long time around pesticides and other chemicals in particular, and I've always thought, it's probably more of a rural issue in terms of, Murray-Darling Basin, obviously it's predominantly agricultural catchment, dairying, cotton, all the fruits and veggies, all that sort of stuff. At Ocean Protect, we're in the urban stormwater game predominantly, so we put in devices to intercept stormwater pollution from urban environments. And it wasn't until you said to me, oh, no, pesticides are a massive issue in our urban environments. Yeah, one of the major users of pesticides is local government for spraying of roadside vegetation. And I was just like, what? And that's when I was like, well, the penny dropped. It was like, well, obviously in an urban environment, there's a direct connection between the land and the waterway because it just goes straight into a stormwater pit, into a pipe and into a creek or a waterway and ultimately often into the ocean. So the connection is really short and sharp, whereas at least, I don't want to make this as an excuse, but at least in the Murray-Darling Basin has to travel thousands, often hundreds of kilometres before it might get to densely populated urban environment or the ocean, for example. So there might be some dilution. I don't want to use that as an excuse. There might be some deterioration of the contamination, but in an urban environment, it's a different story. But yeah, when you started rattling off pesticides and PFAS, I'm like, wow, yeah, I can see how that just goes straight from our urban land into our waterways and oceans. And you talk about the river Murray-Darling Basin river system being destroyed. Equally, I've read one of your other reports, which you've co-authored with a couple other leading scientists around aquatic pollutants in our oceans and fisheries. And one of the first things I read was, and I'll quote it here, it says, this is a scientific report written by three leading scientists around aquatic pollution in our ocean environment, is that I'll quote it. It says, we are at the precipice of disaster. Look, we try to keep upbeat on this podcast, if I'm honest. We try to have a bit of a laugh along the way, but the information that you're providing, and I'd certainly take my hat off to you in terms of your efforts and advocacy, it's really depressing. Particularly in the same report I saw, today there are about 100,000 to 350,000 commercially available chemicals. And something like 5,000 chemicals are produced in volumes exceeding 1 million tons a year. And chemical production is increasing at around 4% per year. But this for me is the kicker. It's only about 1% of chemicals on the market have actually been tested to assess their impact on human health and the environment. That blows my mind, Matt. Like when I hear that obviously there's a lot of chemicals in being produced, whatever. Okay, we accept that. But the fact that there's just so little testing to provide any sort of due diligence or surety to the public that what we're breathing and eating and living in is actually safe and healthy and ultimately isn't going to make us sick or worse. How does that happen? I don't get it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I think it is this expedience that cuts in. Hubris cuts in to the decision-making processes where there may be a demand expressed for a certain chemical. Say, oh, we need this. We must have it. It's imperative. There's very little critical examination of the claim that it's imperative and that everything won't function without it. Usually it's like, oh, you need it. Okay, we will help facilitate access to it. For industrial chemicals, it's a very light touch what facilitation involves. And so hence the real lack of oversight of many, many industrial chemicals. There's a real problem there. Our regulatory system is desperately inadequate to keep up with it. It's one of these cases where business is charging ahead and the regulator is a light year behind. In our case in Australia, our regulator, certainly in the pesticide space, is actually captured by the industry interests. So they're not regulating for the public. They're regulating for the chemical industry interests. So this is something that took some time to really appreciate going in as a person with good faith into the process to try and understand, well, how do we regulate a pesticide? What information do we need to assess? What quality of information is required? Whose information do we look at? Do we look at everybody's or do we just look at certain information? And how do we weight that information? If bits of it are in dispute, as often in science we see that there are different opinions that come through or different conclusions from different studies. Which one do we declare to be ascendant as the study to which we will regulate around? Now, our system, whilst it notionally says it will look at all of the research, it dominantly weights its outcomes towards the research provided by the company seeking to register the chemical. So the chemical company generates its own data, or it hires a research company to generate data for it. You can see there is a risk that a conflict of interest could arise from a for-profit company seeking to get its chemical approved, that it might potentially colour the information that is provided to the regulator, that it might perhaps withhold a study that showed maybe this does cause Parkinson's disease, but perhaps we'd best not talk about that, so we'll do another study and show that, in fact, it's fine. It's rather reminiscent of the system that's recently come to life in New South Wales in relation to asbestos waste, and it's moving into mulch where, yes, let's test for it. We'll check if it's there, but, oh, we found it. Okay, let's test again until we don't find it, and we'll use that result, and we'll ignore the other one. So it's this type of behaviour which, unfortunately, can sit within the assessment process. It's very difficult to detect it. We end up approving products based on information that's deeply inadequate. And we certainly, in this country, still don't have a review system. We have products that were approved back in the late 60s and 70s that were grandfathered into the system but have never had contemporary assessment. Using our knowledge that we've learned through time, the debt of thousands of scientists has built knowledge, alignment. We could apply that knowledge to ask the question, are these products safe in the way in which they're used, applied to landscapes and food? Are they safe? And if we did apply that lens to them now, many products would disappear off the market. We see that in Europe, they are increasingly applying that approach. They have a much more detailed assessment approach than Australia, and they have removed many products already. More than 60 products are gone years ago in Europe, and we still use them in Australia and call them safe. But they're not safe. It's just that our regulatory system is more permissive of risk. And in the regulatory world, we talk about risk as this sort of an amorphous thing. We do a risk assessment and we say the risk is acceptable. I think if we changed the words around and did it a little bit more robustly, we said, how much harm are we willing to tolerate? Because the outcome of failed risk assessment is harm. It's people who develop Parkinson's disease. It's children who develop ADHD as a result of their mother's exposure to toxic chemicals. These are the real costs. These are real harm that is not taken into account appropriately in our regulatory system. And this is part of what is contributing to these dire impacts on our aquatic ecosystem. So what we see is that in many areas, our fisheries are not thriving. They are not expanding or increasingly productive. They're not stable. What we see is that they're in decline, and our response to those declines is to do things. So we do have action, just not the right ones. We have things like marine parks being installed. These are lines on a map that say, okay, we're going to protect the fish. Now, this presumes that the cause of the lack of fish is one single threat, fishing. We caught them all. This is where all the fish had gone. We caught them all. So if we just stop fishing, that'll fix it. They won't be caught and they will all recover, and we'll once again see abundant recovering fisheries. Now, to a certain extent, this has worked, but it's important to look at where it has worked. It has worked reasonably well on our offshore fisheries, well away from the coast, where fish spawn offshore. And that thing you mentioned earlier, Brad, about dilution, it has always been the way of wastewater engineers to say the solution to pollution is dilution. And the further you get offshore, the more dilution you do get. So the impacts from our landscape application, they do go down a gradient. They are highest adjacent to points of application and use as they hit the waterway. And then there is dilution out to sea. So we see that, for example, when New South Wales had a commercial kingfish industry that invented a brand new fish trap, it was a wonderful device. It was incredibly efficient development. It was a cage that was essentially filled with mirrors. They were appealing to the vanity of the kingfish. It is a beautiful fish, and the fish themselves appeared to delight in looking at themselves in the mirror.
I can empathise.
And look at the fish. Look, myself, I thought I've always had a face for radio, Brad, but look, the fish would pile into these traps, and they're immensely efficient as a catching tool.
Wow.
So much so that we fished down the biomass of kingfish in New South Wales dramatically. And we dramatically, over a relatively short period of time, reduced a very large amount of the biomass kingfish was reduced due to this highly efficient fishing technology. The minister began looking at this, and fishery scientists said, look, I think it's too efficient, and we're going to need to ban that trap to support the viability of the kingfish population. We need to let enough fish come through to be breeding age to support the population. So they removed the fish trap, and lo and behold, kingfish numbers recover. Kingfish spawn offshore. They don't spawn in the estuary. They spawn offshore. Now, if we look instead at some of our inshore species and start to look at how they're tracking. So barramundi in Queensland, it's been on an ever downward trend, down and down and down. Many of the fish caught now are, in fact, not naturally reared in the wild, but are bred in a hatchery. They've been stocked out of the hatchery into a dam, and they get out of the dam and overflow into rivers and then get caught in the commercial fishery. We still see some abundant populations of barramundi, but where they occur is very telling. They occur on the western part of Cape York, where there are very few people, where there is no agriculture. They're abundant, annually abundant. Relative changes with the wet season, the bigger the wet season, generally the bigger the recruitment. But when we go down the east coast, that's not so. They're not abundant, not anymore. We didn't catch them all. What we have is that the water quality is no longer suitable to support high levels of reproduction and larval rearing. So the numbers of animals coming through are not there. Now, when I came out of being a terrestrial vet, I used to get quite excited when I went to the dairy farm to pull out a calf and get a live calf out. And it was really somewhat of a triumphant moment to have the cow survive and have the calf survive. But then I was taught you always had to check for twins in case you left one in there. And twins, well, if you got two out, you really were heroic. And on one occasion, I managed to get three out. That was a very unusual occurrence, triplets. What a feat. What an amazing cow. Now, when I look across the fish, they put these terrestrial animals in the shade. Just one pair of barramundi. So two parents can make 500,000 progeny, 500,000 progeny from just two fish. These animals spawn millions of eggs in a single spawning event. This is what creates this incredible productivity that aquatic ecosystems can naturally possess. Now, I accept that much of what I say is immensely gloomy. It's, you know, have you got it any blacker? Not really, it's blank. But I think we must understand the problem to generate the right solutions. So solutions like marine parks, they address fishing, and if fishing is the threat, we would expect them to help. If, however, water quality is the problem, they won't do a damn thing about water quality. Water quality doesn't obey a line on a map. It moves where the wind and the current takes it. And we know on the reef, for example, that pesticides applied onto sugarcane crops in Queensland end up 40 kilometres offshore at levels that stress coral and reduce the temperature tolerance of coral. So the coral can no longer hack higher water temperatures. This is a particularly bad combination of events when water temperatures themselves are rising globally. So we've got less resilience created by toxic exposures and more stress from higher water temperatures. This is part of why areas of the reef are being severely impacted. In fact, most of the inshore reef has long since been damaged and is dramatically changed, and the productivity is dramatically changed. I do get asked occasionally, look, does anyone ever invite me to dinner parties anymore, Brad?
The answer, not to eat
the
fish.
Answer is no. The answer is no, but there is a positive here, and that's to understand that these aquatic environments are unbelievably resilient, as in if you take the pressure off them, so if you correctly identify the problem, remove that stressor from the system, the speed of recovery is really quite remarkable. Within a decade, you can see significant, measurable changes in abundance if you implement the changes to improve water quality. So we see in the Northern Hemisphere countries doing this. We see the Netherlands identifying these endocrine disrupting chemicals throughout their river systems that were impacting on their native fish in that country, accessing and spawning in the river. They're now seeing them return. So I see all of this as retrievable, as recoverable, but it does require us to focus on correctly identifying the cause, and then we can't rely, unfortunately, on government taking the action independently. I'd hope that would work. I participated in many stakeholder consultations. I have spent a very large number of hours compiling very lengthy reports and lots of peer-reviewed information appended to them. And sadly, they have made no effect at all on policy. As a scientist, I find that gutting.
Oh, I can empathise. Like, and I know, again, you're in Ballina and you've looked at the Richmond estuary for decades, I suspect, and I think I spoke to you previously. I was involved in a study, the Richmond River Estuary Processes Study, back in 2004, 2005, and we looked at the bad water quality within the Richmond River Estuary, the massive fish kill that happened, killed off about 2 million fish and crustaceans, et cetera, caused because of inappropriate land usage, essentially, in summary, but we could have a whole podcast on that. But yeah, wrote a many 100-page report, which was only part of another bunch of reports, a whole bunch of stakeholder consultations. It was Ballina Shire Council, Richmond River County Council, Lismore Council, X and Y. You name it, every man and his dog was at these meetings and nothing's happened. And to your point around the report I mentioned before, the aquatic pollution in the oceans, we're on the precipice of a disaster from your perspective, and the implications are enormous. Like, what is it, about a third of the world's protein comes from our ocean environment. So many, I guess, artesian fishermen and communities rely heavily on the health of our oceans. Overfishing is a massive issue. No one belittles that, but often the elephant in the room is this issue around pollution coming from our land-based sources, washing off our land into our oceans and et cetera. But just on that cause, like, you talk about the toxicants flowing from our land into our oceans, and you mentioned endocrine disruptors, but there's obviously a chemical cocktail. Is there particular pollutants that you're think are really important to do something about? Is it pesticides? Is it microplastics? Is it PFAS? Is it endocrine disruptors? Is it sediment? Is it nutrients? What would you suggest would be the key pollutant of concern?
I'd probably take a slightly different approach to the problem in that, so we've identified many of those as being problematic. So nutrient, yes, there's vast amounts of nutrient running off the landscape, well above levels that we know are healthy for the ecosystem. So we might do something about that. Sediment, way too much. We're washing our future agricultural profitability out to sea where we can't use it. We should do something about that. Pesticides, clearly toxic. We should do something about that. So I kind of go to where is it we need to do something and keep tracking. So rather than keep thinking about end of pipe solutions, my interest goes to what's at the source of this and can we really begin to address this at the source? If we have an agricultural system as we currently have, which is dependent on synthetic fertilizer and pesticide, then I think we're buggered. We're not going to end of pipe solution our way out of that. And we're probably not going to agri-tech our way out of that either. We're not going to get there with, you know, a GM tweak in a crop. We have to go back and have a look at that whole food production system and ask ourselves, is it fit for purpose? And is there any other way we could produce food that could lead to a very different outcome? I'm not Robinson Crusoe in thinking that there might need to be another way to produce food. The Europeans are thinking about this real hard and putting real money, real skin in the game, and real support to their farmers to try and help transition. So in France, they have a 25% target that area, so land under agroecological or organic production. So of their farming area, a quarter should be under agroecological or organic production by 2030, a quarter. In Germany, they've gone for a 30% target by 2030. In Australia, we don't have a target. We don't offer any support for transitioning. We are doing the opposite. We are subsidizing the chemical industry. We have patronage to our politicians available to the chemical industry. Not to me, interestingly, Brad. I would like to speak to the Minister for Agriculture about opportunities for food production that could boost our fisheries and that could also reduce our public health budget, but I can't get a meeting. But the funniest thing is that there's a lobby group in Canberra who represents the agrochemical industry, and they have regular meetings. They pay donations to our major parties. This is not an even playing field. On this playing field, science, it doesn't get a jersey. It's not on the field. We need to get science on the field. It needs to be directing the traffic about decision making for how we do food and how we make decisions about these massive fluxes of pollutants and focus our attention back at source, because I think there's real opportunities there, but they are difficult to achieve. It is not as easy just to say, oh, look, change how you farm. Be organic. Stop using chemicals and be profitable and viable as a farm. It is not that easy. It requires a lot of support and a whole transition program of knowledge to strap around that kind of transition. That is the type of change that we desperately need to see in Australia, because a vast amount of our landscape, somewhere around two-thirds of it, is owned by farmers and is managed by farmers on behalf of us all. So that's a lot of the landscape that we need to look at how we manage it and consider, could we be doing it better to not require those inputs, which then do not generate the pollution stream? We should bear in mind in these times of rising water temperatures and stinking hot weather and increasing severity of storms that pesticides are made from fossil fuels. They're a product of the fossil fuel industry. 99% of them, roughly, are made from fossil fuels, oil and gas. Fertilizer is made from fossil fuels. Synthetic nitrogen fertilizer is made from gas. We are not serious about doing anything about these impacts to our wider environment if we continue to predicate our food production on requiring these inputs, because that then requires more extraction of fossil fuels. So we have to get back to source, I think, Brad, and begin to support that transition for farmers. It does require tremendous thought because it will have significant impacts on the market for food, on payment of food. We've seen issues in that space on Four Corners with supermarkets and their power and how that changes the outcome for farmers. I think as a community, and this is where I'm very much of the mind that the opportunity is bottom up. It is for local communities to begin to understand the size, the breadth, and the quantum of the problems and begin to start the change locally. Because unfortunately, due to the way our politics are operating, the change is not going to come from there. I can feel confident after expending more than a decade of my life attempting to see any regulatory change in a rational direction. None has happened. None. It's so depressing. But I see the opportunity and I can't let it go because the recovery is like, right, it's right there.
Yeah.
It's right there. So why not go for it?
Oh, absolutely. Go for it. Go hard or go home. And look, full disclosure, Ocean Protect, we put in stormwater treatment devices to capture pollution. We often provide what could be termed as end of pipe solutions. We provide at source interventions to stop pollution at the source, like literally at the roadside gully pit, for example. This is why we're doing the podcast and a whole bunch of advocacy and political lobbying all out of our own pocket, because we recognize that we're dreaming if we think we're going to protect our oceans without at-source interventions. And that's why we're so vocal around the plastic production, for example. We stop so much plastic stuff in our devices, but it's pushing poo uphill unless we stop production. And fundamentally, production continues to exponentially increase, and that's just not good enough. And I feel as though there's all these chemicals being produced. Very few of them getting tested for safety. These chemical manufacturing companies are making a lot of money. Meanwhile, cleanup groups, community groups, scientists, activists are sort of scrambling out of the goodness of their own heart and passion in their own being to try to mitigate this. But it's an impossible task without addressing the key issue, which is the production of these various contaminants. But I guess, look, it's disheartening to think that the system is broken. But having said that, I agree, the solution is looking at us right in the face. And no one begrudges farmers. I think they do an amazing job providing us food and all sorts of products that we use in our everyday life. And I think the overwhelming majority of the community would love to see them appropriately supported to do as good a job as they can. And meanwhile, I don't think we're short of cash. We've literally committed billions of dollars to a whole bunch of submarines. I mean, there was no community stakeholder discussion around that. It was just a decision made behind closed doors with no community involvement. And we're not really sure whether we need them or not. But what we do need are healthy oceans, healthy waterways, and a healthy land environment. And to do that, to achieve that, we obviously need change in our food production system and just generally our land management system in general. But it also gives me hope. Whilst we might be handicapped by not having very expensive political lobbyists sitting in the back pocket of various politicians, one thing I've seen you do very successfully is use the power of your voice. And whilst you might often be a lone voice on various issues, particularly around water quality in our oceans and waterways, you do a great job. And I see a lot of attention and traction in the stuff that you do. Are you getting enough? No. That's why we got you on the podcast, to give you more of a platform and hopefully go on a billion more platforms and podcasts and YouTube videos, all that sort of stuff to gather attention around this issue. But I guess for Joe Public, for the listener tuning in, is there anything that you could suggest in that they could do in their day-to-day life to sort of, I guess, help protect our oceans and waterways from this chemical cocktail?
There's actually many little things that you can do. Many of them come at really almost no expense. So you can be mindful about the things that you choose to consume and the format they come in. So rather than buy a new Teflon-coated fry pan, buy yourself a cast-iron fry pan. That fry pan won't wash off PFAS down the drain to the wastewater treatment plant. That means that the sludge at the wastewater treatment plant won't contain that contaminant. And when that sludge is moved back out as an agricultural amendment onto pasture or onto a crop of corn, it won't end up in your packet of cornflakes. This is something you can do. You can not store your food in plastic. That means you don't buy the plastic. That means it doesn't need to be made. So consumer choice, you know, part of this is very much on us. As consumers, we are consuming this stuff. We are buying it. We are choosing to buy it. We're choosing to use it. We're choosing to use single-use plastic all over the place when there are options. We could remember to take a bag. We really could. We could go to our local farmer's market. We could support the organic and some of the spray-free and agroecological production that's already happening. I've been tremendously heartened here in Ballan to see that our farmer's market has evolved through time. We now have three different organic farms presenting produce every week, beautiful produce available at prices that are very competitive, cheaper than often the supermarket prices. You can pick it up in your hands. You don't need to have it in a plastic bag or within a plastic box within a plastic bag. You can avoid all of that plastic contact with your food, which also has an impact because it doesn't become waste. It doesn't create waste. There are many other things you can do in your home in terms of, look, understanding that, look, you're beautiful already. Cosmetics are a problem. So many of these things we apply to our faces that are used to improve our appearance. These contain chemicals, some of which are problematic. So a lot of pharmaceuticals contain PFAS, for example. So it's part of how you get your skin feeling extra smooth. It's that beautiful smoothness of the PFAS on your skin generating the cancer that you really don't want to get. This is things that we can actually do. We also can, that idea of supporting our local farmers is very, very powerful because it is by buying their produce that it does support their enterprise. So there is a very virtuous cycle there in our local communities where we can support our local farmers. We create very low food miles food. We don't take the food that we grow, truck it to Sydney to a distribution centre, and then truck it all the way back to the North Coast, burning fossil fuels everywhere we go. We simply bring it directly from the farm within 30, 40 kilometres of the site, and we take it home and we consume it. These are very real things in our reach. There are some wonderful groups that are doing very good work that do need more support. So groups like Landcare do a great job in trying to re-establish things like riparian vegetation. Groups like Ausfish, who are a recreational fishing group that have developed to improve fish habitat. They're very focused on water quality. They're very motivated to try and recover wetlands. So they understand that an incredible proportion, in fact, almost all the wetlands along the East Coast, to use a word that was used at the recreational fishing conference last year, they're buggered. This is not a good descriptor. The word I'd like to see for our wetlands is pristine or functional. how about biodiverse, carbon sinks? That they are opportunities for us to restore wetlands and be involved with these groups of people who are similarly motivated to have their local environment improve. And we know that as your local environmental health improves, your own health improves. These are directly related to each other. So we've got quite literally skin in the game that we want to see a result here that is going to be good for us. So I think there are many things we can do. We can make choices about our clothing. We can choose natural fibres. So we can choose organic cotton. We can choose hemp. So these are very useful materials for construction of clothing. We don't need to choose polyester. We don't need to run on fast fashion. Again, you're beautiful just in that same T-shirt this week, next week, Brad. It's not going to be a problem. I think we can begin to deal with some of this by changing somewhat our values a little bit around where we place our value systems. So I think there are real opportunities for us to do immediate things. Plenty of things we can do to change the game. I think plenty of reasons for optimism, but they do require a very large number of people to get together in a way that we haven't. Like we're not together right now. There's not enough of us together to change the politic. The politic needs to change to change the regulator.
Well, speaking of get together, how do people get together with you and collaborate and I guess get involved with your advocacy actions to change? Are they best just contacting you via LinkedIn? Is that the best way, Matt?
Yeah, look, that's probably a good way, Brad. I really started up LinkedIn as somewhat of an experiment to see what sort of appetite there might be for communicating. I'm somewhat of a dinosaur, really, when it comes to social media. So this is all quite new to me. There does seem to be both an interest in it and a growing interest. I think, you know, people around about 20,000 different views occurred of my post last week. And I think growing that number does help in its own very small way, because it begins to amplify the voice.
I think, Matt, you're doing a great job of raising awareness and attention around these key issues, and they are key issues. We probably need to let you go. I'm hoping this isn't going to be your only appearance on our podcast. It's been incredibly fascinating. It's such an eye-opener, even for someone like me who lived and breathed water pollution for 20-something years. I think that the issues that you're raising and the links between human health and water pollution are just fascinating. I just hope that you become more and more of a household name as time goes on. And obviously, more importantly, we see massive change to the issues that you're obviously talking about. And if there's anything that we can do to assist, whether it's helping put on events or collaborate further or giving you whatever platform you need. I know you've spoken about maybe doing a webinar on some of the things we've talked about today. The door is always open. But on behalf of all the listeners and the Ocean Protect team, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your time today. It's, like I said, it's been fascinating, and just keep up the awesome work. Really well done.
Terrific, Brad. Well, thanks for the opportunity. And I'll try to get around to that webinar idea. I think it's a good one. So we'll get on to that.
Cool. Thanks again, Matt. Boom, boom, shake the room.
Thanks for listening to the Ocean Protect podcast. If you'd like to find out more about us and what we do, check us out at oceanprotect.com.au.